Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Nobody has more respect for women than I do. Nobody.
Hillary Clinton wants to abolish it. Believe me. She wants to abolish our Second Amendment.
I think they didn't deny it. I don't think anybody denied it.
Other presidents did not call. They'd write letters, and some presidents didn't do anything.
Many people have come out and said, I'm right.
You really do have to ask yourself, where does it stop?
Hello and welcome to Fallacious Trump, the podcast where we use the insane ramblings of the front half of a pantomime centaur to explain logical fallacies. I'm your host, Jim.
And I'm your other host, Mark. A logical fallacy is an error in reasoning that results in bad or invalid arguments. And the logical fallacy we're looking at this week is a new one identified by Jim called ignoring linear time.
Yeah, so long-time listeners will know that sometimes I make up slash identify a new logical fallacy.
Spot in actual use. Just make them up and then try and fit the facts.
I identify a common error in reasoning that that doesn't really fit into any of the kind of traditional or already identified categories. And it's, anyone can do this. It's not a rule that they have to be written down somewhere official. It's all a logical fallacy is a common error in reasoning that someone's identified. And what I noticed was that actually I was kind of doing it at a semi-regular level. So I think the first one I did was episode 44, and then almost 11 later on 56, then I did 66, and this is 77. So
wow, well there you go.
Here's another one. And this one is ignoring linear time. So basically, this is when someone suggests that because something hasn't already happened or been done, therefore it either won't or can't happen or be done.
Right.
And there's a few variations of it that we'll see, but they all kind of basically fit that same idea. And obviously, this isn't true because for everything that happens or is done, there was a time before it happened. If someone had said, well, it hasn't happened yet, so it's not going to happen, they would have been wrong.
Yeah. It puts me in mind of somebody at some stage said all the tunes that are ever likely to have been to be written have been written.
Yeah. It's an extremely common thing. Patent people have said everything that was ever going to be invented has been invented by now and things like that. Yeah. And they're always
way before the microprocessor. The 1700s. Uh-huh. Yeah, before steam.
And when you're living, I think, in a less accelerated technological environment, I can see how you would think that when the most up-to-date stuff you've got is pretty impressive, and you haven't seen an incredible change over the last 30 years, then you could think, this is it. This is the peak. We're not going to get any better than this.
For all those people who visited Stonehenge for the summer solstice on the 21st, they're all going, well, that's it. We're never going to make anything. That's
this is it.
One-story really high. That was really hard. Like putting stones on top of other stones without them falling over, that's it. This is the peak of technology. It's never going to get any better than this until Og comes up and goes, I've invented a bronze axe. Shut up. Yeah.
So our first example from Trump comes from his second debate with Biden. And this was really his only argument in the entire debate that kind of he tried to make. I guess just because he can't keep more than a couple of things in his head at once. So this was, amongst all his prep, this was one thing he remembered to say over and over again, which was basically whenever Biden said anything he would do when president.
They should not be going to jail for a drug or an alcohol problem. They should be going into treatment. That's what we've been trying to do. That's what I'm going to get done, because I think maybe the American people have now seen that, in fact, it was a mistake to pass those laws relating to the drug. But they were not in the crime bill.
But why didn't he get it done? See, it's all talk, no action with these politicians. Why didn't he get it done? That's what I'm going to do when I become president. You were vice president, along with Obama as your president, your leader, for 8 years. Why didn't you get it done? You had 8 years to get it done. Now you're saying you're going to get it done because you're all talk and no action, Jim.
We got a lot of it done. We released 38,000. We got 38,000 prisoners left from the...
You got nothing done.
38,000 prisoners were released from federal prison.
So Joe actually handled this really well because he did point out that... Well, he didn't point out, you can say that about anything I say I'm going to do. Why haven't you already done it?
Yeah,
but, but he did point out that they had already done a lot of stuff towards this goal.
And it also kind of ignores the fact that the Republicans would have blocked absolutely everything they tried to do at the time. And then he says, that's the problem with you politicians, all talk and no action. Okay. So what are you then, Trump? Either not a politician, so therefore you can get away with all talk and no action. It doesn't apply to you. Yeah.
But the most egregious version of it, I think, happened in the first debate.
He says he's smart because he can take advantage of the tax code. And he does take advantage of the tax code. That's why I'm going to eliminate the Trump tax cuts. And I'm going to eliminate those tax cuts and make sure that we invest in the people who, in fact, need the help. People out there need help.
But why didn't you do it over the last 25 years?
Because you weren't president. Because you weren't president screwing things up.
You were a senator.
You're the worst president America has ever had.
Yeah. That's right, yeah. So I'm going to reverse the Trump tax cuts. Yeah.
Why didn't you do
that? Why didn't you do it 25 years ago? Well, you've answered your own question there. If you'd paid attention for 2 minutes rather than just determining what you had to say, if you actually listened, what? That's exactly it. How he thinks that carries any kind of weight at all, trying to push the burden of action back onto Biden by saying, the things you're going to do that I put in place, why didn't you get rid of those 25 years ago before I put the 21 years before I put them in place? And also, why pick on 25 years ago rather
than...
I know,
that was weird,
very odd.
But he also has done it with Hillary. When he was talking about Hillary's chances of ever combating ISIS when he said this.
So they started as a very small little seedling, and they grew out of the vacuum left by the way we got out, right? The vacuum in Iraq. And they grew. Right now they're in 32 countries. 32 countries. And she's been there. If she could have stopped them, she would have done it already. I'll stop them, folks. I'll stop them. Believe me.
So again, if she could have stopped them, she would have already done it. Suggests that it's... Yeah. First of all, it suggests it's easy. And therefore, the fact that she had any power at all as Secretary of State, essentially, means that if it was possible for her to have done it, it wouldn't have taken very long, and so she would have already done it.
Yeah, so it skips over the fact that she probably didn't have sufficient power to be able to do that stuff, and actually it was... Yeah, and if it was due to the absence of American presence in Afghanistan or wherever, then ISIS grew out of that, and then what would they do? Send them back in? But that, which is, and Trump was all about getting the troops out of Afghanistan because we ought not to be there anyway. So he had no compunction about thinking, well, okay, so we'll make another vacuum, which will get replaced by ISIS 2.0.
Which is exactly what happened when he took Trump's troops out of Syria. Yep. So, yeah.
And now is the time, I think, for Mark's British politics corner.
Well, as seems to be the usual case, British politicians kind of avoid these direct, I think any politician, actually, American politicians prior to Trump, probably... also avoid these direct and fairly crude accusatory remarks. So even Boris's favourite thing, act of calling Starmer, Keir Starmer, the leader of the opposition, Captain Hindsight, you would think would yield examples of him, well, you know, you wanted it done so much, why didn't you do it then? And I think the problem we have currently in British politics, apart from Boris, is that... Starmer's never been in power. He only became a Labour MP in 2014. And Labour hasn't been in power for over a decade. And the lack of stuff getting done and calling up that ghost, you know, notwithstanding Trump did it with Biden civil 25 years ago, it's plainly something Boris doesn't want to talk about, because the lack of stuff being done is due to the party that he belongs to. So my example of it comes from a Channel 4 news report about Home Secretary Priti Patel's new immigration and asylum rules from March 21.
In 2016, the British people withdrew their consent to be governed, in part by the European Union. They also withdrew their support for a broken immigration system. We, therefore, have a democratic mandate and imperative to fix it.
So in the light of that, they're kind of positioning this as a broken immigration system, so that we can then... But they haven't got a democratic mandate. We know they haven't. And nor do they have an imperative to fix it. It's fundamentally populist politics to be the party of controlling immigration. So in the light of this announcement, Channel 4 News' Cathy Newman asks Chris Philp, the Minister for Immigration, Compliance and Justice, this.
Chris Philp, the Conservatives have been in power now for 11 years. If the asylum system is broken, why haven't you fixed it before now?
Well, until just a few weeks ago, of course, we were in the common European asylum system, the so-called Dublin system. So now we've left that at the beginning of January. We have an opportunity to fundamentally relook at the system, which we are now taking today. In addition to that, the legal system has evolved over time with case law and so on, making the system difficult to operate and requiring fundamental reform.
So basically he's kind of just towing the party line, throwing in also that pesky lawyers have kind of pointed out the illegalities of what the government's trying to do, which obviously needs reform.
Hasn't
they need to take away that power.
Legal complication stuff mostly happened under the Tories, though.
Well, yeah, exactly. And so Cathy Newman is exactly right when she says she deliberately employs the fallacy. You've been in power for 11 years. If it was broken, why haven't you fixed it before now? So the implication is this thing's been, you haven't done it yet. Why haven't you done it now? So he goes out of his way to avoid taking any responsibility for that. Instead of, well, I don't know. You see, I don't know whether he's... No, he probably isn't. Whether he's smart enough not to fall for the fallacy, but he's failing to counter it. What he could have said is, just because it hasn't been done yet doesn't mean we aren't able to do it now. You know, and he could have added...
Yeah, I think one of the ways, like as Biden used to counter it with our first example, is if you have things you can point at to say, these are steps we've taken towards solving this problem.
Yeah, yeah.
Then that helps. If it is something that would easily be fixed or could easily be fixed and you're still saying, yeah, we're going to do that, then it's reasonable to say, why haven't you already done it?
Yes, exactly, yeah. Or what they're saying is, it's all Europe's fault.
Yeah, but the main thing is, most of these things aren't easy to be fixed, but the person who's being asked is claiming it's an easy fix and claiming that they know how to do it. And that's the problem,
exactly.
Is that, like with Trump saying, I'll knock the hell out of ISIS.
Yeah.
You know, by setting it up as this easy thing, when you then don't do it, people can say, well, you said it'd be easy. Why haven't you done it?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So they're kind of, so what they're doing is not saying, it's something we can fix. They're saying, well, now the Europeans are out of the way, we can mend what is a broken system. But actually what they're doing is clamping down on the lawyers who are fighting the illegality of what they're doing, you know, and pretending they've got a mandate to do that and a moral imperative to do that. Well, they haven't. It's just what the Tories do because it's a populist thing to do. He could have just said, if he was an older and wiser politician, and we'll come to an example of that in a minute, he could have said, well, you know as well as I do that that's a fallacy. What you've just said there is a fallacious argument. That would have disarmed her, but because he doesn't, because he's a politician, and if he could...
Also because this balance, he hadn't been identified until...
Well, yeah, they'll...
Until now.
So. Well, they continued until 15 minutes ago. Yeah, he wouldn't have known it. Right, yes, exactly. But anyway, needless to say, undaunted by his waffle, Cathy's follow-up question is this.
Do you accept, though, that over the years that the Conservatives have been in power, the Home Office has actually got worse at managing the system? So, for example, 10 years ago, there were almost 42,000 returns and removals. In 2019, that had fallen to just over 19,000.
Yeah, well, as the Home Secretary said very clearly today, the system is broken.
Well, yeah, but so there you... So
it's become progressively more broken during our administration.
So he wasn't able to say, unlike Biden, you know, we released 380,000 people, because the figures are, you know, they're terrible. Because if you're the party that returns more illegal immigrants than any other party, 10 years ago, Theresa May was the Home Secretary. Remember Theresa May? And... Yeah, is that one? She failed to continue to enact certain border controls that were available under the EU agreement, which conveniently led to the stance on the Leave campaign for Brexit, keep the foreigners out, because the EU won't let us, which wasn't true. And we talked about that probably years ago, that that was a lie. And Priti is still peddling that with the EU. It's the EU that prevents us. But also, it's circular reasoning, isn't it? Because he kind of said, well, you know, it's a broken system.
We broke it.
Yeah, and we broke it. And he said, well, you know, but you haven't fixed it yet. I know, well, that's because we weren't able to. I said, well, yeah, but the numbers have gone down. Whilst you've been in power, I said, oh, well, that's because the system is broken. Yeah, but it's the same system that enabled you to deliver... You know, X thousand, 42,000 10 years ago, the system hasn't changed and now it only returns 19,000. So you broke it. That's, yeah, that I know. It's Jesus Christ. You see, but they, yeah, and the so as far as the British government is concerned, they're breathing a sigh of relief because they can continue to blame it on the EU, a bit like Starmer blames everything on Corbyn. They can continue to blame it on the Europeans because they put pesky little things like human rights legislation in amongst the treatment of refugees, immigrants and asylum seekers. But now they can get rid of all of that and go, well, yeah, we can keep brown people out, you know, and... to prevent things like the Delta variant coming into England. Oh, no, that all went horribly wrong then. So our second example is in 2015, the Tory candidate for the Mayor of London, Zach Goldsmith, said this.
By far the biggest challenge London faces is housing. Now, the answer is not easy, but it is simple.
So how does that do? How does that got anything to do with the fallacy? Well, that quote, it's not easy, but it's simple, comes from the Labour peer who was looking into housing, the housing crisis during the Labour administration, so under Blair and Brown. And he's called Andrew Adonis. Yes, really, he's really called Lord Adonis. And he wrote an article called How to Fix the Housing Crisis. And the article begins, in my experience of public policy and government, big challenges do not always require complex solutions. Often the essential reforms are simple. I'm also wary of the jibe. If it were simple, it would have been done already. But this confuses simple with easy. If simple reforms are controversial and difficult to implement because they radically change the status quo, then politicians tend to default into waffle, half measures or complex tweaks of the status quo achieving little, which is pretty much sums up the early examples as well. And I think, you know, it's probably me and my biases, but Adonis seems to be, because he's twice the age of Philp, Goldsmith and Patel, it makes him sound more aware, reasoned and considered in that he's identified, you know, sorry to disenfranchise you, Jim, but he's identified as a jibe early on. So if only Philp was aware of that, he could kind of go, or even Goldsmith was aware of it. rather just nicking it from Labour and using it in his bid to be the Lord Mayor, the Mayor of London. There's this oversimplification of, well, Trump is a great example, because he'll just deride the opposition, whoever it is, whether it's Hillary or Biden, for saying, I will do stuff. And he kind of implies, well, if it's so simple, why haven't you done it? You know, and if she can't do it, I'll do it. But he's conflating simple with easy. I mean, it's a simple solution, but it's not easy to implement. And that's where the people descend into waffle.
There's a parallel, I think, to this fallacy is the absence of evidence one, right, which we talked about a number of episodes ago now, where as with many informal fallacies, this is context dependent. And obviously there are contexts where this seems to, it's like set up in the same way, but it's not fallacious. And with the people saying that, you know, if the evidence of absence isn't absence of evidence, we said it is evidence of absence if you've looked everywhere you would usually expect to find the evidence.
Yeah.
If you've looked everywhere and you still haven't found anything, then that is evidence that maybe there wasn't anything there to be found. It's not necessarily proof, but it's evidence in that direction. In the same way here, if all of the criteria, all of the things were in place for this to be able to be done, and the motivation to be done, and the, all of the kind of means and opportunities were there, and it still wasn't done, then that's possibly evidence in favour of, if it was going to be done, it would have been done already.
Yeah.
If at some point we all succumb to fallacies, then make it fun. Logic gets harder to outrun, and I'm quite loud, so I can't be wrong. Bad theories and dirty tricks, the rest is Trump history onyx. We all gish gallop at breakneck speed. Slow it down, it's a fallacy. A wild fallacy. Come on, come on, your argument's wrong. Come on, come on, a wild fallacy. You do me wrong, do me wrong.
There we are, the vaccines there with Wetsuit.
And in the fallacy in the wild, we like to talk about the fallacy of the week from a non-political perspective. And this week, our first example comes from the excellent film Yesterday, which is genuinely one of my favourite films of the last couple of years, in which a struggling musician...
The entire
musician,
premise is this fallacy, really,
A struggling musician finds success due to a kind of magical event that happens where he ends up awakening in a place where he's the only one who remembers the Beatles existing. This scene comes much earlier in the film, where he's decided that he's had enough, and this gig that he's just had was kind of his last one. It's not going to happen for him.
I think I hear something special in my songs. You think you hear something special, and I love you for it, but no one else does. No one ever has.
Nick loves the summer song.
Nick is famously a world-class moron. If it hasn't happened by now, it's not going to. It'll take a miracle.
Miracles happen.
Cue the rest of the film.
There you go. Yeah.
But yeah, that feeling of if it hasn't happened by now, it's never going to happen, is a common one. And when you are doing something difficult, whether it's looking for a job or looking to kind of move house and find the perfect house for you, or, you know, all kinds of different things which are hard to do and take a long time, it's very easy to feel at some point along that journey, it should have happened by now. If it hasn't happened by now, it's not going to happen. And that's always true until it happens.
Yeah. the second bit isn't. It's not going to happen.
No. That bit's not true. It's always true that it hasn't happened yet. Yeah. Until it happens. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, yes, with all those things, like a job or looking for a house or whatever, You may look at several or apply to many, but you only need one success amongst all of the ones that aren't suitable or don't go the way you wanted. So
for me, it triggered thoughts of the thing that, you know, savings organisations always say, investment organisations say, past performance is no guarantee of future results. So that's, you know, if you bear that in mind, that's, it's amazing that the world contains both the, if I haven't found it by now, I never will, and past performance is no guarantee.
Well, that's why they need to keep reminding people of that.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And also that kind of the gambler's lament, isn't it? You know, that is the opposite of that. It's like, well, I'll keep losing, so I'll keep going because at some point I will win.
Yeah.
Which is just as true as I'll keep going and at some point I will lose.
Yeah.
But, you know, neither of them.
Lost everything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So our second example in this section this week comes from Castle. And this is, I believe, the first episode of season three. Castle decided at the end of season two to kind of walk away from the police and his helping them solve crimes thing, partly because his relationship with Beckett was difficult. And in this first episode, he finds himself basically back with them because the victim is someone he knew.
Look, Castle, I'm sorry about your friend. I really am. But that doesn't mean that you can just show up and act like nothing has happened. The truth is if you wanted to come back, you would have already, but you didn't. So let's just face it. The only reason that you're here right now is because you were at the wrong place at the wrong time.
He sees it basically as a sign that it's time to come back. And she's saying, if you wanted to come back, you would have already done it. Again.
Right.
He could have wanted to come back. At some point, he wanted to come back and hadn't already done it.
Yeah.
And wanting to come back but not already doing it was true up until the point where he came back.
Yeah, up to the beginning of season three.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I've decided that. And you've got to, I'm not going to listen to what you're saying now, because if you wanted to do what you're wanting to do right now, if that were true, you would have done it already. Well, no. No. Because, you know, prior to that, it's perfectly possible that somebody wouldn't want to do that. That doesn't negate the genuineness of him wanting to do it now.
Absolutely. It's a very frustrating thing to argue against, because it seems like a really good argument to the person making it.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes, it's difficult to counter. You just have to go, no, wait a minute, wait a minute.
Think this through.
That could well be true, but I have changed my mind. Yeah. You know, up until yesterday, that was true.
But even if yesterday he wanted to, or 6 months ago he wanted to. In fact, the truth is, he always wanted to. He never really wanted to walk away. So
it was
true all the time that he wanted to come back. But you don't necessarily immediately do the thing you want to do.
No, yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. That's, yes.
Yeah.
Because that's called restraint. Yeah.
And,
you know, if you really want it, but that's just reminded me, I once spoke to my mum and said, she said, why don't you play? Because I did take up the clarinet at school. And because I wanted to play the saxophone, but they didn't have any. And she said, why didn't you continue the clarinet? And I said, well, that's because I think I want to play the drums. And she said, if you wanted to play the drums, you would have already been doing it.
Yeah, see, there you go.
And you think, what? And she said, I haven't seen you going around tapping the furniture. And you think, okay. And because it's, you know, your parent, and you think, well, yeah, they know what they're talking about. Actually, it kind of crushes you utterly.
Well,
it's not true.
It's weirdly prophetic, because our next example is another Nathan Fillion one, but this is from The Rookie. And and this is where his character, John, I think, has a bit of a difficult relationship with his mum, who has come to visit. He's had difficulty while she's there and wants her to leave.
Don't worry. I'm giving you exactly what you want. I'm leaving.
If you were leaving, you'd already be gone.
Yeah.
Well, "For what, huh?"
Now, to be
now
fair,
that you pointed it out, when you kind of look at these things, they actually, you've made them all ridiculous.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, hopefully listeners will do that for you. You know, when this occurs, you'll just go, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah.
To be fair, in this scene, what he means by that is, for some reason, so if all you wanted was to go, then you would have already gone. Is kind of what he means by that. Yeah.
There you go. Yeah, yeah. If that's all you wanted to tell me, or if that's all you wanted me to know, you wouldn't be sitting down now with a cocktail in your hand and, you know, and a cigarette on the go with your feet up. Yes.
Here's another one. This example is from The King of Staten Island, where Pete Davidson, his mum has started a relationship with after his dad's died, with a new man. And the new man's played by Bill Burr, and Pete's character goes to Bill Burr's ex-wife to find out about him so that he can tell his mum negative things about her new man and try and break them up.
Right.
Basically. And he's confronted by the new man.
You went to the person that hates me the most to get the worst review you could possibly get. Why didn't you come down here and ask these guys what they thought of me? Did you ever think of doing that?
I'm sorry. You're right.
You're not sorry, or you wouldn't have done it.
Yeah. That, to my mind, is an absolutely classic example of this, and one I've certainly heard before, is if you were sorry, you wouldn't have done it.
Yeah. But the thing is, you can't, because when you proffer an apology, it's because of something that you've done.
That's,
you know, hence the filmmaker's adage, it's better to ask forgiveness than permission.
Yeah.
That is, that, you know, you do something and then you realise it's wrong and then you offer up an apology because you've made that realisation after you have done it, that it was something that you ought not to have done and therefore can apologise for. You can't...
Yeah, you can't be sorry about something you haven't done yet.
That's the very definition of being sorry, is for something you have done.
And it's a bit of a kind of toxic relationship thing.
Oh, yeah.
To say. It's you know, obviously, it's nice to accept apologies when offered, especially if they're sincere. It's kind of, it's almost gaslighting to tell someone they're not sorry when they're telling you they are sorry.
Yeah.
And to kind of offer as evidence for that, the fact that they did the thing they're now saying they're sorry for.
They're sorry for,
So therefore they can't possibly be sorry because otherwise they wouldn't have done it.
Yes, that's textbook gaslighting, isn't it? Well, maybe not. I think textbook gaslighting is all the things that happened in Gaslight.
Yeah.
That probably wasn't one of them. But, yeah, I came up with an example from Eminem. It's like the one of Naughty Jack from Spinal Tap about a serial killer. Eminem plied that particular furrow with one called Same Song and Dance. It's a cheery ditty about a serial killer. And the lyrics go... Come with me to Brighton, let me relieve your tension, you little wench, your murder wasn't my intention. If I wanted to kill you, it would have already been done.
Yeah.
You kind of go, you can't have done that because you've just picked her up in a club and then you're trying to entice her into your car. And as your defence is, well, look, I'm not going to kill you because if that would have happened, I would have done it. That's quite threatening rather than reassuring, you know, I would suggest, you know. And then she gets in and he lynches her with 66 inches of extension cord. And
it's not an uncommon turn of phrase actually in movies, is, you know, if I wanted to kill you, you'd already be dead. Kind of a badass villain type thing to say. And one of the reasons I didn't include something like that was partly because, I mean, in this case, it's immediately followed by him actually killing her.
But, yeah, exactly, yeah.
But,
yeah, yeah.
But in most cases, it's kind of them saying as proof that they don't want that thing.
Yeah.
Is saying, if I have had the opportunity to kill you and would have done if I wanted to. So it's kind of offering that as genuine evidence that they don't want to kill you, in a way.
Yeah.
That they don't want you dead. which is reasonable.
The ongoing subplot of Breaking Bad, really.
Yeah. So an example that I found of where this is kind of similarly used but not fallacious,
right,
was when four British yachtsmen basically capsized in the Atlantic coming back from a regatta in the Caribbean.
Yep.
And the US Coast Guard and various other organizations searched for them for a few days, actually. One of the searchers basically gave a statement to the press. He said, we searched with multiple assets over 4,000 square miles for pings from the vessel's personal locator beacons. After receiving no more transitions, we believe that we would have found them by now if we're going to find them. These beacons are small devices, and the ones being used have a very short battery life. So he's using it the same way. If we were going to find them, we would have found them.
Yeah.
But he's using that after they've searched a lot over a large area, and at the point where the things that would help them to search, i.e. the battery-driven beacons, are probably now no longer operational. So it's absolutely true in that case to say that their opportunity, their window of finding them, is now gone.
It's now up.
If they were going to find them at any point, they would have already found them. So there are absolutely ways of using this in a non-fallacious way, but if you hear someone saying, if it was going to happen, it would have happened by now, often...
Or you're not sorry.
That's a fallacy.
You're not sorry, or you wouldn't have done it. Yeah.
So we're gonna play...
Fake news, folks. I love the game. It's a great game.
I understand the game as well as anybody. As well as anybody.
Yes, it's time for Fake News, the game where I read out three Trump quotes, two of which are real and one I made up, and Mark has to figure out which one is fake news.
But there's kind of no point in playing it, really, because if I was going to win, I would have done so already.
The thing is, we can disprove this, in a way, because we could have said early on, if you were going to do better than chance, you would already be doing better than chance. But now you are. So
There you go. Yeah. So, yes. So, all the things that
if you were going to get higher than 50%, you would have already be there by now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is probably true. Since we've been, how long have we been doing this? 3 years?
3 years, yeah.
Probably true. I mean, you know, it's kind of never say never, but, you know, it's like the sun will come up tomorrow because it always comes up tomorrow. You know, at one point, that won't be true.
Yeah. You know, anyway, on that cheery note,
right, billions of years, folks, billions of years. It's fine.
These examples are all from Trump's kind of first speech back out in the world when he went to the GOP state convention in North Carolina. And, I mean, he rambled basically for about 90 minutes.
I thought you were going to say completely, utterly changed, and we realised that the entire term in office was an absolute made-up persona.
Yeah, no, he rambled for about 90 minutes. He endorsed a couple of people. He talked about how he probably loves Lara Trump more than Eric. And Eric's a bit short because he's only 6'5" and Barron's 6'7", and things like that.
Yeah,
but
little Alex.
But he also played all the hits and did some new stuff too. So these are some of the things he said.
Yeah.
Number one, what we have to do is we know what we have to do, and that is stand up for our country. Because if we don't stand up, we're going to lose our country. And the people that are in charge right now, they're unbelievable. All the things they want are very, very bad. Bad things are happening on a level that nobody's ever seen. You see what goes on? It's all defunding. Defunding. Can you believe this? It's a disgrace, what's happening. We can't allow it to happen. We're going to take our country back and soon. Probably a lot sooner than you think.
Yep.
Number
all
two.
The hits are there,
He said...
Yeah.
We did things that nobody has ever done. I'm very proud of the biggest bet. This was maybe the greatest bet ever made in the history of the world because we saved a year. We bought billions of dollars of this vaccine before we even knew it worked. And because of that, we've all, most of you, I guess, all of you, just about, in one form or another, you've had your shots or jabs, as they like to call it. I actually like the other word better. But we've saved a lot of lives. We've saved all over the world. We've saved millions and millions of lives, and I'm very proud of it.
You've had it in one form or another. You've had a shot. Like, you know, it could be like a light, internal light, or a kind of a cleansing. Yeah. One form. You've either have a shot or one form or another.
And statement number three,
okay.
This time he was talking about his visits to Dover Air Force Base to kind of meet fallen soldiers' coffins back.
Right.
It was the most terrible thing to watch. And the general in charge would say, "Sir, you're going to see things you maybe will not have seen." "Like what, General?" He said, "Mothers and wives and even fathers sometimes breaking through the military ranks and jumping on top of the coffin. And I got to see that one time where a mother was just absolutely, she was devastated. She jumped on and these incredible, extremely fit soldiers are taking that coffin and would jump onto the coffin and they wouldn't do a thing. They would just keep walking."
Oh, right. As they're carrying it.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. Righto. Righto. Like what, General? Like he would say that. Sir, you can't. Yeah. I hate the way he talks about himself in the third person.
He touched a lot of topics in this speech.
Yeah, yeah. He's gone over a lot of ground and tried out some new material. He played the hits, you know, kind of like two for them, one for me, off his new album. You know, then a couple of the hits and they're all shouting, "Play the old stuff." Yeah. Okay. Right. The biggest bet of the thing, well, he's going to brag about the vaccines because it seems to be working. Or is it? And a bad thing happened. Defunding what we have. What we know to... Okay, well, despite the fact that the jumping on the coffin thing is a new thing, I quite like that one, but that might just be you trying to sneak in a new thing without it. Damn you! Okay, what we have to do is... Okay, I think that number one is the one you made up.
Okay.
Yeah.
So of the other two, which are you more convinced by?
I'm more convinced by number two, the biggest bet.
Okay.
Yeah.
So number two is...
Yeah. Is, yeah.
Real.
We did things that nobody has ever done. I'm very proud of the biggest bet. This was maybe the greatest bet ever made in the history of the world.
Because
we saved a year. We bought billions of dollars of this vaccine before we even knew it worked. And because of that, we've all, most of you, I guess, all of you, just about, in one form or another, you've had your shots or jabs, as they like to call it. I actually like the other word better. But we've saved a lot of lives. We've saved all over the world. We've saved millions and millions of lives, and I'm very proud of it.
Apart from the fact that riddled with lies,
uh-huh.
it's his usual little bouncing ball of this kind of... It goes on topic, and then, like with a bouncy ball, it kind of goes dip, 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 like that. And he's kind of like, and because of that, we've all, well, most of you, for some of you, you've had shots, might be a shot. I like the other word. Da, da, da. And it kind of just peters out. And you think,
he was very low energy in this, in this speech.
Yeah.
He was a bit slurry.
Kind of the greatest. Bet ever made in the history of the world.
Yeah, the greatest bet ever made in the history of the world. And as someone who has run a casino into the ground, he would know.
He would know that, the greatest killing in the history of the world.
Yeah.
You know, they killed more people.
I mean, the thing is,
saved a year.
A bet kind of implies that there's some risk involved, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And that he kind of foresaw... That it would
well,
work
exactly,
out.
Yeah, that you're kind of playing the long game.
Yeah.
Or, you know, but actually what he did was short the bet as well. He kind of went, okay, 500,000 people dead. Yeah, we might have to invest in an untested vaccine. Well, that's kind of outlawed.
Well, here's the risk that he took, according to the New York Times.
Yeah.
And they made, the administration made agreements with all of the different vaccine developers. But... For the Pfizer one specifically, which was the first one developed that was developed with money from Germany, no money from Operation Warp Speed went into the development. The federal government made an agreement for $1.95 billion, which would cover the first 100 million doses. That kind of maybe sounds like a big investment.
It's got a billion in there.
The entire...
Yep.
The entire cost of Operation Warp Speed, including this, including the cost of all of the vaccines up to the point where Trump left was 12.4 billion, which is almost exactly the same amount that Trump paid American farmers because of his China tariffs.
There you go. Yeah.
But this almost $2 billion, according to the agreement, was only paid to Pfizer after the drug had been approved by the FDA and the first 100 million doses were delivered to Americans. So there was no money
not much
being
of a risk,
paid.
Then.
No, absolutely not. They only paid if it worked.
Yeah, and after they...
Yeah, they didn't
it
pay it up
worked, and they put it into 100 million arms.
Yeah.
Wow.
So there was absolutely no risk on the part of the US government in that.
And it's such a measly amount of money compared with the £37 billion we paid for the track and trace system.
Yeah.
Yeah, now that was a bet that didn't pay off.
So I don't think I'd call it the biggest, greatest bet ever made in the history of the world.
Did he save the world.
No, not at all.
Save all over the world.
Yeah.
Because, you know, his investment in Pfizer...
Well, there wasn't any.
They
may not have even got it yet if Pfizer haven't vaccinated 100 million people yet.
And he was very clear that he wasn't going to spend money outside of America. He wasn't going to make it available to the rest of the world until the whole of America. Yeah.
So you also thought number three was real?
I do.
And number three
is
real.
Yeah.
It was the most terrible thing to watch. And the general in charge would say, sir, you're going to see things that you maybe will not have seen. Like what, General? I said, mothers and wives and even fathers sometimes breaking through the military ranks and jumping on top of the coffin. And I got to see that one time where a mother was just... she went just absolutely, she was devastated. She jumped on, and these incredible, extremely fit soldiers are taking that coffin and would jump onto the coffin, and they would just keep walking. They wouldn't do a thing. They would just keep walking.
Now, this clip was retweeted or tweeted by the Columbia Bugle with the heading, "Moving story by President Trump on seeing our fallen soldiers brought back home and speaking with their families." And it was
a moving story.
Yeah, it was retweeted by Candace Owens, who said, "Incredible man. This is why the left is going through incredible efforts to try to silence him and the majority of Americans who want him back." It's also a total fucking lie.
He didn't do any of that.
It is a complete and total made-up story.
Wow.
Trump went to Dover Air Force Base four times during his entire presidency. Which is appalling.
We kind of talking about that before, where he would say, I can't stand it, I don't do it.
He went within a few weeks after his disastrous raid in Yemen went badly wrong and killed a soldier. He went to support the return of that soldier, and the soldier's father refused to talk to him at all. After that, he didn't go back for almost 2 years. Four times in his entire presidency. They are very well documented. Nothing like this ever happened. The closest thing that happened was at one of the events, a woman kind of ran towards the plane when the coffins were being brought off, but was stopped by military personnel and kind of comforted and brought back behind the lines.
Right.
But that happened before he even arrived.
So he wouldn't have seen it.
Trump,
yeah. You can kind of tell that he's telling a lie because that whole bit about sir.
Yeah.
When everybody addresses him as sir, he loves saying that. And then he follows it up with the response to them as, you know, major or sergeant or.
Yeah. But this whole section, this was an extended monologue about the stuff that happened when he went to kind of Walter Reed Hospital and met soldiers who'd been wounded and went to Dover took part in the returns. And it is unconscionable that he is using these people's stories, making up stories about them.
And putting himself in there.
Yeah, acting like he cares about the troops.
Yeah.
to get people's kind of
doesn't give a shit because directed call them sympathy losers, towards him. Or didn't,
oh yeah, suckers and losers, losers. Absolutely. Why would they? Yeah. Why would they fight? Yeah. What were they getting out of it?
And even his tone is kind of like late Lenny Bruce. It's that sort of the stuff when he's being sued for saying motherfuckers on stage, and he's just getting tired and he thinks he's still funny, and yet there's that cognitive dissonance where people just want him to be the saviour, to be the wise, empathetic person he's never been, by saying, oh, it's a very moving story. He said, yeah, it's all made up. He doesn't give a shit about you. It never has.
Yeah.
Can you not see he's trying to wheedle his way back into your affections like a really bad ex?
He took John Voight with him on one of his trips to Dover Air Force Base.
Yeah.
Like a kind of, you know, come and see the dead soldiers meeting.
Yeah, yeah.
It's so fucking weird and disrespectful.
And it's that kind of... And there's that movie reference because John Voight played a comeback boxer or something, and all of that stuff where he's kind of like the old soldier or the old boxer who's getting up to do it for his daughter.
With, to be fair, in the chat, ring. Ricky Schroeder, who has also turned into a right-wing arsehole in recent years.
What is it about those people?
All of which means that you got this one right.
Hey! Yay! All right! Aha! Oh, yeah. Ha-ha.
That was
fantastic.
My number one was based on a kind of rambling section that, which it wasn't really clear what he was talking about, but what he was talking about was largely about kind of standing up for getting our country back and everything will be good, and now it's bad and it will be good if we do the right thing and all that kind of stuff. It didn't make any sense. About anything. He just kind of lost his place on the teleprompter for a bit.
It's the bit where when he's getting up from the, you know, it's the Sammy Davis Jr. stuff where they kind of go, oh, look, Sammy D's in the house. And he kind of walks from the cocktail table way back over there.
Yeah, up got to fill the time.
Yeah, yeah, does a little bit of rambling. Kind of go, hey, how you doing? Where are you from? Yeah, all that kind of stuff.
So basically that means that you have clawed your way back up to 47%.
You see,
congratulations, you're getting closer and closer to that 50%.
Yay! thanks for the vote of confidence. That's right. You know, it's not so much a win as, you know, I never kind of win these things. It's just that you lose.
Yeah.
That's how you look at these things. It's not, we don't celebrate a victory. We commiserate you for another loss. Yeah.
And this is the part of the show that this week, at least, is called GB News is Not a Logical Fallacy, because in the UK we've had a new TV channel start up in the last couple of weeks called GB News, which is fucking amazing.
And it's kind of, it's frightening and awful in turn. It's kind of, some of it's kind of disappointing because some of the presenters, they're kind of mainstream BBC presenters. They're the people that got into trouble with the BBC for being really harsh journalists and holding leaders to account in a way that actually the BBC advocates around the world. Andrew Neil, you know, he was the one that kind of was the big beast that Boris would refuse to go be interviewed by, because he would just kind of cut him short and say, well, you're a idiot, a liar and a charlatan.
But Andrew Neil has had enough of people being in any way politically correct or woke or kind of kind to anyone.
Well, I think it's, you know, it's a bit like John Humphreys who was on the kind of current affairs show on BBC Radio every morning. He said, well, yeah, I kind of retired and gave up because I didn't want to get up at 4 a.m. every day. Now I'm in my 80s or whatever it is. But actually, he just become, as most, you know, sort of, maybe it's true. I hope it won't be true of us, of course, but that people, as they get older, they move more to the right. And they just become intolerant, gammon-faced right-wingers who kind of moan about the young people of today. And when they say the young people of today, they mean the Beatles in the 60s. You know, they're kind of, yeah, with their long hair and their smart suits and their close harmonies, bringing down the fabric of society. They're the kind of, they are, they become the people they complain that their parents had become. So they're just...
But there's plenty of young right-wing people on the GB News as well. But basically it's been set up as a right-wing news source, essentially, in response to, commie pinko news companies like BBC.
Cancel culture, Those kind of outlets like Sky News, Channel 4 News, BBC, where they think actually what we should do is not have an opinion but present sides of the
globally
story.
Globally respected news organisations.
Yeah, you know, holding people to account by maintaining a kind of moral high ground. But, you know, all of that stuff has got in the way of people just being able to say what they want about the number of coloured people in my neighbourhood.
Yeah.
You know, because there's, as we know, the right-wing voices are being stymied all across the media outlets, despite the fact that all but maybe two, maybe three of the newspapers in the UK are right-wing newspapers, and, you know, which publish constantly the right-wing voices, you know, that, and people go on Twitter and complain about how right-wing voices are being quashed to their 7 million followers and appear on television and say right-wing voices are not being heard on the mainstream media.
But the best thing about their new book, GB News, is the fact that it seems that all competent TV technicians, like behind the scenes people,
none of them liberals. Went with them.
Because it's fucking awful. It's like a bad student TV station.
The thing is, we've both been on student TV stations. That's where we learned
absolutely.
That from. And ours were much, much, much better.
Hence why
TV station. I haven't come across any bad student, except for maybe the one in Wayne's World. That was of cable TV, really shit cable TV.
Yeah.
That kind of.
Yeah.
But that's taking the piss out of really bad TV stations. It's that kind of stuff. It's the ones that don't actually exist. They're fictional. They're really bad. They're awful. That's what it's like. I mean,
Their chyrons are almost all misspelled. They put the wrong name for people. They spell people's names wrong when they do get their names right. On the on-screen graphics that show you where their reporters are reporting from, they're almost always wrong. It usually says live from Huddersfield, despite the fact that someone is, you know, in Cardiff and someone else is in Cambridge.
Outside the famous hospital in Cambridge, talking about hospital things, live from Huddersfield. And it's kind of like there is American viewers must have come across it, Alan Partridge.
It's very Alan Partridge-y.
It's properly Alan Partridge-y. Uh-huh. If it wasn't, I wouldn't be surprised if it didn't have a Chris Morris credit.
I mean, if it
right
wasn't
the
for
end.
The fact that Richard Madeley has become Alan Partridge, like completely on Good Morning Britain, it would be the main Alan Partridge station. But also they're having enormous amounts of technical problems with microphones and connecting to people who are kind of connecting with them via Zoom or whatever. Michelle Dubry, whose claim to fame was I think coming second in a series of The Apprentice in the UK. She's one of the presenters, and she was kind of happy to have a guest in the studio because then they wouldn't have any technical problems. and then they couldn't cut to the other person, so her interview with him was just her talking and then a voice coming from off camera.
No. So it might as well have been on Zoom.
Yeah, absolutely.
With no camera.
Yeah.
The clip I really liked was when somebody's speaking and there's somebody drilling in the background. So they're still building the set.
Absolutely.
Or something behind them.
There is a great Twitter account called @GBNewsFails, which has compiled just the first week. They've stopped after the first week of kind of amateurish bullshit that this news station has done.
Well, even the live stuff, I did look at the Twitter feed of the actual live account, and there's Simon McCoy is kind of reading out, ostensibly, you know, reading from the auto cue, but he's in vision, the laptop in front of him, uh-huh. and he's looking off camera, holding a remote. So he's obviously operating his own auto cue, but you're not seeing the view through the auto cue.
Yeah.
Normally, you know, they look straight into the camera in front of which the auto cue is being projected. So it's just,
and,
you think,
yeah,
what
and
the
Simon
fuck?
McCoy yeah. does a yeah. regular a kind of good news section.
Yeah.
Which I think is supposed to be ironic because his persona is a little bit of a grumpy bloke. And for a couple of nights running, they couldn't show the pictures that went along with his good news stories. And the thing is, the good news stories were based entirely on the pictures. So he was kind of trying to describe this thing that people had kind of thrown mud at to make it funny.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he was saying, oh, you know, I really wish we could show you the picture because that is funny. It's a good picture, but we can't. And
how hard is it?
Just,
oh,
I know.
God.
Hold on. Fuck it. When we both worked at Channel 5, we had a kind of, there was a program for people to see what other people's jobs were like. Right. And not a lot of TV production happened at Channel 5 at the time. They only really did the news. The other stuff was all bought in. But we went to the National Film and Television School in groups of like 20, and we spent a weekend kind of team building and stuff
right.
like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, yeah.
And we did a news broadcast, and I was picked to be director in the gallery.
In the gallery. Yeah.
Kind of calling the shots and the vision mixing and all of that kind of stuff. And the one that we made on our first day of trying to make a news program, that was just, you know, a couple of presenters who'd never been on camera before, people working the cameras who'd never worked a camera, me in the gallery, we made a far better news program than anything that has appeared on GB
News. With no experience in 20 minutes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I know. And that's the thing, you know, Simon McCoy is kind of... It's weird because I've actually worked with Simon McCoy, and he's very good at the off-the-cuff stuff where he makes a comment on the ridiculousness of whatever's going on, and he's really very good at that. And
to be fair, he did also take a ream of paper on camera once.
That is true,
to
pretend to be a I mean, there's those things where you just kind of think, yeah, we're not going to be able to fix that in post because this is live. Yeah, we're not. It's not like the rehearsal. Yeah, so it is. Yeah, and as an editor, and you know, we kind of know that you need to sustain people's engagement with stuff. You've got to be able to deliver the pictures to support the words because actually they're somewhat more powerful, and having the chyrons running underneath. As kind of, illustrating what they're saying, as the third element of reinforcement of the message, you know, you need to have all of that going on at the same time to have a rich experience, and it's just so amateurish. There's no,
And they don't. They're having like phone calls and emails and stuff going straight through to the studio rather than through a producer, which has resulted in them getting. And reading out on camera messages from people like Mike Hunt and Mike Oxlong.
And Hugh Janus. Excellent.
Yeah, and Hugh Janus. Yeah.
That's so good.
And they have no filter.
I'm looking for Amanda
Huggenkiss.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah.
It is Bart Simpson level stuff.
Brilliant. That is brilliant.
It is.
It is so good. And what's great about it is that, you know, the great British public, to whom they think they're serving, is actually gets wise to it far quicker than
do. Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So they would just kind of jump in and you know, pull the trousers down live on air and things like that in a kind of witty British way. But that's, yeah, but there was a great thing that somebody tweeted and called it, there's a children's TV channel in Britain called CBBC, which is children's BBC, and the kind of the preschool version of that is called CBeebies, like children's BBC babies. And so somebody tweeted, this is GBBs, like GB News. So it's GBBs. And they described it as something for the woke kids to sit their gammon-faced parents in front of for a couple of hours to keep them quiet whilst they get on with sorting out the world. So it's kind of, it's an old people's home for people whinging about Harry and Meghan.
Oh, God,
or,
yeah.
Very, you know, yeah. The triple lock pension, or, you know, it's all of the
pro-Brexit
stuff that anti-Brown and,
yeah,
people,
yeah, yeah.
It's all that. It's Alf Garnett. If Alf Garnett was reading the news or Archie Bunker was reading the news, this is what it would be like.
And obviously one of the things they're very against is cancel culture.
Yeah.
And in the first few days, a number of their advertisers decided to pull their ads. Many of them, it seems, had not been aware that their ads were going to be shown on this channel. I think because it's done through kind of aggregators and Sky Media, I think, is the organisation that actually places the adverts on behalf of brands. So brands like IKEA, Vodafone, Grolsch, cider company called Copperberg, Specsavers, opticians company, they've all said, no, we don't want our company associated with these values that are being expressed on this channel.
Which are very xenophobic, misogynistic views.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
So in the interest of being against cancel culture, there have been calls to boycott all of the companies that have pulled their...
Brilliant.
Adverts from GB News.
Brilliant.
Just because companies aren't choosing to pay them money.
Yeah.
So they're like, right, well, we're not going to IKEA anymore.
Well, it's that kind of whole self-righteous, self-entitled, white supremacist thing.
Uh-huh. One of the best things I've seen about GB News is in, I think it was The Express, which serves exactly the same demographic.
And kind of points out the value of the houses will drop because of whatever.
And they were talking about, first of all, how GB News had, like, in the first few minutes, they had kind of 330,000 viewers and were beating Sky and the BBC put together. They didn't go into detail over how the fact that it was just the first few minutes and within an hour it was down to about 150,000 people.
Yeah.
They talked about how people were now that there is an alternative to the BBC news, people were cancelling their TV licences and just watching GB News, because of the weird fucking system we have in the UK, you have to have a TV licence, even though the money only goes to the BBC. You have to have it to watch any live TV.
Any TV.
Watching GB News, you still have to be paying your TV licence.
Yeah.
So that isn't a solution.
Yeah. No.
So I hope many of them are doing that, and that the vans with spinning roof racks go around down their street. And
the TV detector vans that we were all terrified by in the 70s and 80s, and you think, well, at the time I did think, well, if they're spending all this money on advertising to tell us about the van, why don't they just come and get us?
I could do a Wonder Woman 84 length rant about TV licensing, but I'd better
not. And second class stamps. Yeah. And finally, some things we really don't have time to talk about.
A local Fox News reporter in Houston decided to end her career in style last week when she opened her report on the Texas heat wave with this.
Thanks, guys. That's right. Before we get to that story, I want to let you, the viewers, know that Fox Corp has been muzzling me to keep certain information from you, the viewers. And from what I'm gathering, I am not the only reporter being subjected to this. I am going to be releasing some recordings about what goes on behind the scenes at Fox because it applies to you, the viewers. I found a nonprofit journalism group called Project Veritas is going to help put that out tomorrow, so tune into them. But as for this heat wave,
it seems like if she was any good as a reporter, she might have looked into Project Veritas's reputation. But then if she was any good as a reporter, she probably wouldn't have been working for Fox in the first place. Conservatives, who feel like Fox is a bit too left-wing, got all excited about what the revelations would be. Fox, meanwhile, immediately fired Hecker and then told the Daily Beast, "This incident involves nothing more than a disgruntled former employee seeking publicity by promoting a false narrative produced through selective editing and misrepresentation," which is a fantastic bit of ignoring linear time. Like, sure, now she's a disgruntled former employee. Anyway, it turns out that Hecker was being muzzled because she wasn't allowed to do stories about Bitcoin during the 5 p.m. broadcast, because nobody who's watching then cares about Bitcoin, and that she was told she failed as a reporter for still pushing hydroxychloroquine stories long after it had been debunked. So, yay, Fox?
Maybe. He who it is not legal to believe, Tucker Carlson, is, as usual, breaking the law of causality on Fox News in his explanation of who was behind the Capitol Hill insurrection on January 6th. After all, those involved, he calls them unindicted co-conspirators, have not been prosecuted yet. Yeah, but that's because lawyers are building cases in the world's most litigious country, that's probably wise. Nor, says Carlson, has any of the subjects been named. Well, yeah, see above. Why is that, he asks. Obviously, he didn't hear me explain either of those just then. And he doesn't even wait for an answer. But in true racy wrist, registered trademark fashion, well, if anti-fascists can be diminished into Antifa, then cosplaying conspiracy theories can be diminished to racy wrist. In true racy wrist fashion, he allows his audience to simply use their biases. You know why. It's because they are almost certainly working for the FBI. Ah, oh, yeah. Silly me, that could be the only possibility that logically and inexorably follows. The government knows who they are and yet won't arrest them because they work for them. Those of us familiar with the need for a lodestar to follow amongst the leader-craving directionless Q, Q-plus and Q-curious racist communities, see our sister podcast for patrons, recognise the ache for absolute certainty that comes with stupid. Carlson is the anonymous twat, sorry, tweeter, being a bully behind a humourless ID. He's the little skinny kid waving his fist from behind the bigger kid saying, yeah, thump him, go on, as Tucker himself says. This is crazy and we should resist it. Yeah, too right, quick, before the likes of Marjorie Taylor Greene add extra wheels to the populist bandwagon in an attempt to get the racist community to unthinkingly give her lots of money. Oh, no, I think we may be too late.
A long time ago, Mark and I ran a film festival together. Well, we totally overestimated the local interest in independent film and hardly anyone showed up. In a totally unrelated story, Mike Lindell, the pillow salesman who looks like someone ordered Ron Swanson on Wish.com, held a rally the other weekend in Wisconsin and, well, hardly anyone showed up. Most embarrassingly, the jets that Mike expected to fly over at the end of the national anthem didn't show up either, leaving Mike awkwardly standing on the stage looking into the distance and saying, "Is that them?" It wasn't. In other rally news, Trump announced a tour with Bill O'Reilly through the end of the year, and Trump's most ardent supporters, the QAnon crowd, are furious. Yeah, I thought they'd be happy too, but it turns out that this messes with their theory that he's going to be back in the White House by August. Honestly, I don't know why this is the mental hurdle they can't pole vault over, because usually they believe six much more impossible things before breakfast. Meanwhile, another barrier to Trump's return to power might be the announcement that the Manhattan DA's office is now investigating Trump's COO and former bodyguard, Matthew Calamari, which, to be honest, I only bring up for one glorious reason. And this is a story which you will not believe, but I fucking swear is true. And I first heard this through a Twitter account, which is at This Twit Is Lit.
Right.
And the person who runs that account had done some research into Matthew Calamari and got his birth certificate. Right. And to, because I couldn't believe this was true, I signed up for a free trial on Ancestry.com so that I could look at the original document. And
I fucking swear to you,
in on his birth certificate, under birthplace, it says Matthew Calamari was born at sea.
Wow. That is brilliant, isn't it? But of course you would be. And is it written in squid ink? Is a signature. That is brilliant.
It's my favourite thing ever.
That is so good. And it's kind of, you know, it's a something slightly fishy about him, et cetera, yeah. Et cetera. Yeah. Insert your joke here. Yeah. We all have that uncle who at Christmas, when we were a kid, could make a spoon stick to his nose. And when we asked, could someone explain it, they played along saying it was magic or magnetism because we were like four. Now, imagine getting someone to do that before a committee in an Ohio state house as part of a Republican campaign to advance House Bill 248, which would prevent schools and businesses from asking people if they're vaccinated, for instance. So your uncle, who's now well into his 90s, is demonstrating his party trick to them. And you, now an adult in your 40s and a qualified medical professional at that, are asking the gathered judiciary to explain it for you. Somewhere between acute embarrassment and the tooth fairy and Santa, no, spoiler alert, someone would cough and mumble and talk about capillary action, the combined curvature of noses and spoons, and your uncle would nod, and the spoon would fall off and the cat would be out of the bag. Ridiculous. Never happened in real life. Except, yes, it did. Last Tuesday, an anti-vaxxer nurse, in an appeal to her own authority, tried to defend Dr. Cherie Tenpenny's testimony about magnetic vaccine crystals. Spoiler alert, no such thing. Which channels 5G signals? Nope. By sticking a key magnetically to her chest.
No, a brass key, no less.
Yes. Yes. Those kind of, you know, bit like a penny isn't magnetic. Something about the interplay of almost horizontal surfaces of her chest and moisture, and then also failing to do the same to her much more vertical neck with the key and even a much lighter hairpin. Turned out she'd learned this over lunch, that it would be possible, possibly from the joke book that came with the Happy Meal her uncle bought her. Neither the hearing committee nor Dr. Cherie Tenpenny has thanked her for her testimony. However, gravity, the public behind her, and a mass TV audience laughed in a four-year-old reddening face.
There is a great video on Twitter of a guy who has who sticks a nickel to his arm, right. Like where he had his vaccination, and says, yeah. You know, I've been told that what I need to do is put some baby powder on this and try it again. So here we go, uh-huh. I'm going to do this. And yeah. He does it. And obviously, immediately, the nickel slides off.
Yeah.
And then he kind of just looks at the camera and goes, OK, I have an apology to make. It's absolutely brilliant.
It's like, yeah. So if you were sorry, you wouldn't have done it.
Yeah.
That is brilliant.
Texas GOP Congressman Louie Gohmert was obviously listening to our last episode and heard that Mo Brooks was making a run at the coveted title of dumbest congressperson. Well, Louie said, hold my motherfucking beer, and secured the championship for 2021. On a Zoom call with Jennifer Eberlein, the Associate Deputy Chief of the US Forest Service, Gohmert started brainstorming ways to combat climate change and recalled that NASA had said that the moon's orbit was gradually changing, as is the Earth's orbit around the sun. And he asked the grown-up he was talking to, is there anything that the National Forest Service or the Bureau of Land Management can do to change the course of the moon's orbit or the Earth's orbit around the sun? Obviously, that would have profound effects on our climate, end quote. Now, there are those who say he was being sarcastic, which he wasn't, and still more who say he was just being a science-denying asshole claiming climate change is not anthropogenic. Of course, when one of the options is a Republican politician being a science-denying asshole, that's usually the right one. But I feel those people are just failing to grasp how profoundly stupid Louis is.
Yeah, nothing to do with Occam's razor. Or watching the day the Earth caught fire. It's actually, yeah, it's like some kind of light, like some kind of cleansing. Can we not just, you know, alter the... Can we not just swivel the Earth a
not
bit?
Not just us, but like the the Forestry Service. The
commission, yeah.
Can they not do something about the orbit
the
of
people
the
that have got, you know, like intercontinental ballistic missiles?
They're having enough trouble raking their forests.
Yeah. With that, they need Trump to show them how to do it. Yes, exactly. Remember when we were all exhorted to make America great again? In the possibly rather retro FBI acid-tested Cold War mind of good old boy Tom Cotton. Yes, Republican. Yes, Arizona. America great again was somewhere between Sputnik and Neil Armstrong. Steeped in black and white, Dr. Strangelove, Cold War sci-fi, racy wristism. He's written a letter. Yes, he writes. And yes, he's that old school. To Joe Biden, warning about the true intent of the hosts of the 2022 Winter Olympics. In the letter, Cotton warns Biden that Beijing plans on using the 2022 Winter Olympics as a giant funnel for precious American DNA, harvesting the nation's fittest and finest for their genomic information as part of a plan to achieve military dominance. Well, apart from the seemingly genetic co-presence of predilections for racism, obesity, distrust of communist principles in the very DNA of all American heroes, he could be onto something. No, he isn't. He is Slim Pickens, riding the nuke to its target, wahooing his cowboy hat, ignorant of any and all ramifications of his misogynist, xenophobic, warmongering, racist attitudes. Yeehaw!
It was the G7 last week, and Joe Biden visited the UK and met with the Queen and various world leaders, all of whom looked significantly more relaxed now that they don't have to make awkward small talk with Bloaty McBloatface. On the whole, Biden seemed to do pretty well. But, of course, Hannity and the rest of the Fox News team characterised the entire visit as a disastrous embarrassment. But heaviest condemnation came for his meeting with Putin. Basically, it seems that sometime in May, the entire Republican Party and right-wing media went to that company from Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind and had all memory of Trump's disastrously embarrassing 2018 summit with Putin in Helsinki erased from their minds. At least, that's the only explanation for the official RNC statement that, quote, giving Putin a meeting is just the latest win that Joe Biden has handed Russia. Or for Hannity saying, quote, Vladimir received a massive platform in exchange for zero concessions whatsoever. What they didn't mention is that Biden didn't sign with Putin over every US intelligence agency, defend the fact that Putin's a killer on the grounds that America's got a lot of killers, or call him very smart.
Yeah. In British politics this time, hopeless bloke Dominic Cummings says hopeless bloke Boris Johnson called hopeless bloke Matt Hancock a hopeless bloke. A fucking hopeless bloke, to be precise, on WhatsApp. Nothing we didn't know. And which, of course, has made no difference. Driven by data, not dates, Boris Johnson reneged on his promise to lift all COVID restrictions by 21st June and postponed it to 19th July. Because of the Delta virus, he failed to stop coming into the country by May 15th. The intervening space will, of course, be completely spaffed up the wall by useless blokes and will be no further forward, backwards, sideways, or in any direction by then. It's beginning to dawn on them that putting all the vaccine eggs in one fixed COVID basket might not be the best policy if the fall guy, Matt Hancock, actually falls over and reveals that there is no actual point to putting the prick in the arm of 50 million people if you still can't stop the virus numbers rising. Or that such a large and inoculated populace will begin demanding that they might at least go and stand in a field in the open air with other disease-free people and listen to music from the likes of the vaccines, for instance. Perhaps we should just use the combined magnetic might of all 50 million of us to pull the screws out of the padlocks to the door of number 10 Downing Street, swarm inside and reveal the emperor therein in all his new clothedness. Ooh, no.
So that's all the bad arguments and faulty reasoning we have time for this week. You'll find the show notes at fallacioustrump.com. And if you hear Trump say something stupid and want to ask if it's a fallacy, our contact details are on the contact page.
If you think we've used a fallacy ourselves, let us know. And if you've had a good time, please give us a review on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can support the show at patreon.com/ftrump. just like our strawman level patrons Max Beaver, Kaz Tui, Stephen Bickle, Smoots, Mark Reiki, and Amber R. Buchanan, and our top true Scotsman level patron Lauren. Thank you so much, everyone. We really do appreciate your support.
You can connect with those awesome people as well as us and other listeners in the Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/fallaciousTrump.
All music is by The Outbursts and was used with permission. So until next time on Fallacious Trump, we'll leave the last word to the Donald.
That's right. Go home to mommy. Bye. Bye.